KZFR 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Chico, California. The following is an encore presentation of Philosophers on Culture.
Welcome to Philosophers on Culture. I'm your co-host, Robert Jones. I'm joined by my co-host, Troy.
Yes, another co-host over here.
Troy Jollimore. Hey, we are really fortunate and honored to be joined by Professor John Sanbonmatsu. John is Associate Professor of Philosophy in the Department of Humanities and Arts at Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Massachusetts, where he teaches classes in ethics, philosophy of technology, and existentialism and phenomenology, among other topics. Professor Sanbonmatsu received his PhD in the History of Consciousness program at the University of California at Santa Cruz. He is the author of The Postmodern Prince, A Critique of Post-Structuralism, and an Attempt to Reconstitute Left Social Theory. And he is the editor of the book Critical Theory and Animal Liberation. His new book, which we're going to be discussing today, is titled The Omnivore's Deception, What We Get Wrong About Meat, Animals, and the Nature of Moral Life. And John is also the president of his university chapter of the American Association of University Professors. John Sanbonmatsu, welcome to Philosophers on Culture.
Delighted to be here.
So, John, first of all, what the heck is the omnivore's deception?
The title of the book is a reference to a bestseller that came out in 2006 called The Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan, the nation's premier food writer. And he's become kind of the guru and go-to guy for anything having to do with agriculture and the problems of agriculture and how to redeem agriculture. So that book was partly a critique of corporate agriculture and a defense of animal agriculture. And as part of that, it was an attack on animal rights and vegetarianism. So my book, The Omnivore's Deception, is partly a rebuttal of Michael Pollan's arguments, but it's a broader look at our violence against animals and the way that we've constituted our civilization around the domination of all the other beings of the earth. I'm trying to look at the ideology of meat consumption and human dominion as ideology. So it's, I think of it as ideology critique. Well, what does that mean? In other words, just looking at the excuses that we come up with to continue causing terrible harm to billions and indeed trillions of other sensitive, intelligent creatures. So the reason I call it the omnivore's deception is not only or primarily because the meat industry, of course, is engaged in propaganda for the animal economy, but because we deceive ourselves in what Jean-Paul Sartre called bad faith. We deceive ourselves into believing that that what we do to other creatures is defensible in some way, even though at some level we know it's not, we don't want to examine our assumptions and we don't want to examine our behaviors. So that is kind of the approach in a nutshell. And I describe what we do to animals as radical evil. It's not simply wrong, in my view. It's so far beyond that that we have to compare it to other historical crimes like genocide or slavery.
I think it's really important to clarify the notion of bad faith in the existentialist sense that you're talking about and connect that to what you see as the way that we are existing in bad faith vis-a-vis non-human animals. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So, yeah, bad faith in colloquial terms simply means, you know, you're being dishonest and purposely misleading somebody. But Sartre had this idea that we could enter into a kind of deception with ourselves. So we're both the deceiver and the deceived. Well, if you just sit for a moment and try to deceive yourself, you can't do it. And so there's a kind of shell game going on where you're hiding the truth from yourself, and yet at some level, you know, deep down that there's something that you're avoiding. And so it's an existentialist problem because, according to Sartre, we have freedom. And we constitute ourselves and our meaning, the meaning of our lives. So we have a responsibility for that. And essentially, bad faith is an attempt to evade our responsibility for our freedom and for who and what we are. And so Sartre wrote a very important book in 1946 called Anti-Semite and Jew, where he looked at anti-Semitism as a structure of what he called bad faith. And he described anti-Semitism as a project, a total project. It isn't just a prejudice or a belief. And this we can talk about misogyny or racism in the same way. It's not just that people have a mistaken view of women if they hate women, or they have a mistaken view of black people if they're white people. It's that they're committed at some level to this view because it's a way of constituting their identity. As a way, in turn, of avoiding certain aspects of reality. So, in terms of our treatment of other animals, I argue that we see a similar structure of bad faith, where I get my value as a human being precisely by defining myself against all the animals in the world. That's why I have human dignity. And if you treat me like an animal, that means that you're not treating me like a human. And the implication being, of course, that other animals are meant to be treated this way, that's their inferiors, and they're put on the planet to serve us, and their lives don't have any inherent value. So in ordinary discourse as well, the hunter says, well, I'm going out there because otherwise the deer would starve if they weren't culled periodically. When actually the hunter just likes to kill the deer. I mean, that it's not, there's no, the hunter doesn't have compassion for the deer, because the hunters are not the ones that I see on the street corners handing out leaflets about factory farming or something. They're just not, it's not there. And, you know, similarly, Barbara Kingsolver, the award-winning novelist and writer, and progressive, has in her book Animal Vegetable Miracle, compares our killing of animals to taking penicillin and killing bacteria, or harvesting plants. And she says in her book, I don't like the word killing. So the animals she kills on her farm, she prefers harvesting, she says, because killing is a culturally loaded term, quote unquote, you know. So she criticizes vegetarians for becoming upset when a farmer decapitates animals, but not becoming upset when a farmer cuts the heads off of lettuces, as though those are ontologically and ethically similar acts, which they aren't, you know. So Kingsolver is a super smart person. She's not an idiot. So the only way to read something like that, when someone says something like that, is either they are intentionally lying to the reader, or in a way they've convinced themselves. They're not examining their own assumptions and beliefs because they don't want to take responsibility for the fact that, in Kingsolver's case, she is deliberately imposing harm, extreme harm, violence on these helpless beings, vulnerable beings, because that would not make her look good in her own eyes. So she has this whole elaborate set of ideological justifications, including the idea that animals are natural tools. She describes them as biological property, which is a very bizarre concept because we know property, of course, is a social convention.
Can I ask, because I don't know her book, and so this is coming out of genuine ignorance of her position, is this rooted in some sort of religious view on her part? Because I know a lot of people have views like that, and they're backed up by religious commitments. They think they find it in the Bible or whatever it is. Is that the case with her? Or is
no, and this is what's so interesting. I mean, in delving into these issues, what I've found is that there's this, I've described this as ideology, and for listeners who aren't aware what that is, ideology is a kind of more or less closed system of beliefs that's self-reinforcing. So it's a pejorative term. So what I found in looking into the ideology around our domination of animals is there's a coherence around it through different cultural forms, different historical periods, across cultures and across time, and, okay, across the secular versus religious divide, right? So, yeah, you would think that King Sovereign is coming from a point of view of like a monotheist idea that, in Genesis, God comes and gives all the animals to us. So humans have dominion or given dominion over everything that crawleth and swimmeth and so on. But King Sovereign prides herself on being a feminist leftist, hardcore secularist. But it's the same idea of a hierarchy of what the ancient Greeks called the chain of being. You know, Aristotle's view that the stronger are meant to dominate the weaker. And so, in my book, I have a couple of chapters specifically on the relationship between slavery, our slavery of other humans, and our enslavement of other non-human beings. And the ideology, as I show, is it's identical. It's not even similar. It's the exact same arguments that we see today being used to justify, quote, humane meat and compassionate killing and animal agriculture, exact same arguments that were once deployed by Aristotle in the Politics 2,500 years ago, and that were used by the antebellum slave apologists in the United States to defend racial chattel slavery.
That's the voice of John Sanban Matsu. You're tuned to Philosopher's Own Culture here on KZFR 90.1 FM here in Chico. I'm Robert Jones. I'm joined by my co-host Troy Jollimore. This program, Philosopher's Own Culture, is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Digital Path, providing high-speed internet for your home or business. Digital Path offers flexible plans with expanded data and speeds up to 200 megabits per second. Details about Digital Path service are available at 800-676-PATH. That's 800-676-7284 and at digitalpath.net.
Philosophers on Culture is also made possible by Chico Community Acupuncture, offering accessible and effective health care through acupuncture. Chico Community Acupuncture promotes general wellness and offers relief from aches, pains, and stress. At Chico Community Acupuncture, payment is based on a sliding scale. Located at 1815 Mangrove Avenue, appointments and information are available at chicocommunityacupuncture.com, on Facebook, and at 530-345-5300.
And John, we're discussing John's new book, which it's so new that it hasn't even hit the presses yet. It's called The Omnivore's Deception, What We Get Wrong About Meat, Animals, and the Nature of Moral Life. One of your chapters has the following title: Freedom is Slavery. In this chapter, you're making a comparison with regard to the arguments used to justify slavery and then the arguments used to continue and confirm this ideology of human supremacy. There are people who take offense to the fact that animal rights folk often compare the suffering of humans to, say, the suffering of non-human animals. I'll talk a little bit about that, if you could.
You know, it's completely understandable that people would be sensitive about this, because especially black people who have been compared to animals for centuries and centuries as a way of, quote, dehumanizing them and therefore legitimating their treatment, right, at the hands of whites. But that comparison only has political weight, or it only works because of our degraded view of the animals, right? If we didn't think that other animals were simply beneath us, and if we didn't have contempt, violent contempt for their very lives, then we wouldn't be offended when we were, if we were to be compared to them. But in the, you know, kind of the economy, as it were, of signs, symbols in our culture, it's so potent to compare a human to an animal as a way of dehumanizing them and degrading them and even preparing for genocide. I mean, this is what, in practically every historical case of genocide that I'm aware of, perpetrators began by comparing the targeted group to some class of animals. So once you do that, since the lives of non-human animals have no worth in our society, you prepare the way for the liquidation of the group, right? So Jews, of course, were compared to vermin and parasites and bacillus, as Goebbels writes in his diary and so on. So I understand the sensitivity. And that said, I'd make two points about that. One is, when I and others make, at least I can't speak for others, when I am comparing what we do to other animals as, or describing it as a form of slavery, or showing the parallels and overlapping structures, I'm not only talking about racial slavery. Slavery was simply an accepted institution in the ancient world for thousands of years in Asia, parts of the Americas, the Middle East. So and that was before it became racialized. It's really important to understand that. Even in the 10th century, so this is long before racialized slavery reared its ugly head, you had this discourse in this text of just an explicit parallel between enslavement of humans and non-humans. And the other thing is that historians of slavery believe that human slavery was modeled on and grew out of what we call domestication, but which was the application of force and violence to non-human animals. Let me actually read a brief quote from David Brian Davis. So he's no longer around, but he wrote a book with Oxford called The Rise and Fall of Slavery in the New World, which is like the classic work on the origins of slavery in the New World. And this is what Davis wrote, quote, "To control such non-human beasts, humans not only branded them, but devised collars, chains, prods, and whips, and also castrated and subjected certain animals to specific breeding patterns. The continual comparison of slaves to domestic animals suggests that as formal wars developed between more densely populated societies, similar techniques of control were used on captives." And if you read Aristotle on slavery, he basically is saying, yeah, you know, animals are four-footed slaves and humans are two-footed slaves, you know, and they're both compared to tools. Charles Darwin in the 19th century said, quote, "Animals whom we have made our slaves, we do not like to consider our equal." And that's a very insightful point. It's the reason that we treat other animals as our slaves and as commodities isn't because they have this ontologically rooted inferiority. It's that we see them as inferiors because we find it useful to exploit them and to harm them. So that's a long-winded answer. So again, I just want to reiterate that, yeah, I understand people's sensitivity, but the fact is that human slavery was based on animal domestication, and the ideology, the justifications we use for both are identical, not even just similar, but I can show that they're identical.
To me, one of the really interesting things about that happens in the all I'm thinking about here is the history of ideas in the West, basically. So small topic. One of the really interesting things that happened, this is such an interesting example of a larger phenomenon, I think, is this way that certain ideas stay with us even as other fundamental ideas change that ought to affect it. And so I'm thinking about, again, you mentioned this idea of the great chain of being, which we had in the West for many centuries, where everything had its little place and there was a hierarchy and everything sort of knew where it belonged, or at least we human knew where everything belonged, and some things were more important than other things, etc. And then, of course, Darwinism comes along, gives us a completely and radically different picture of nature and how things are. And yet somehow, for quite a long time, and even up to the present for a lot of people, that idea of the great chain of being continues to exist. That should have been completely uprooted and expunged by Darwinism. And instead, people immediately started interpreting Darwinian theory in ways that made it compatible with that and said, oh, well, you know, Darwinism shows that there's more evolved creatures and less evolved creatures. And so, of course, it makes sense that the more evolved ones are more important. They have more rights. They can use the less evolved ones and so on.
I think that's so important, what you said, and I completely agree. And so, like, if you look at the paradigm that scientists now work in, it's really an amalgam of several incompatible ontologies, metaphysical views of nature and animals. There's the great chain of being, this idea that, yeah, there's some are, you know, Darwin comes along and says, well, basically there are these fundamental continuities between all species, and he denied that there were any qualitative differences between humans and non-humans. And he wrote a whole book on the expression of emotions in man and animals, quote unquote. And he goes and shows that, you know, even reason and, that, you know, these things can be found to more or less of a degree in other beings, which was Aristotle's position in his History of Animals, you know, 2,500 years ago. So it's a kind of a return to Aristotle. Aristotle didn't have a view of natural selection or evolution, but in terms of his behaviorism, his understanding of what animals were like, very similar to Darwin's. Anyway, so Darwin comes along, and as you say, what's retained are these ancient, archaic views of natural hierarchy, biological hierarchy, dating back to the Greeks and before the Greeks. And so today, you know, that view is shared by, you know, the Harvard PhD molecular biologist, as well as, you know, some fundamentalist Christian. Everybody's on the same page about that, which is odd. So you've got Darwinism, you've got the ancient, I would say mostly Greek, and then monotheistic view of a natural hierarchy and human exceptionalism and humans as a thing apart. And then also on top of that, plastered on top of that, is Cartesianism. And Cartesianism, especially in the 20th century, you know, comes out in these subtle ways in behaviorism, you know, the stimulus and response model, you know, up to Richard Dawkins and the selfish gene, where he has this kind of mechanistic view of consciousness and so on. And so it's very peculiar because, you know, Darwin comes along and says, hey, everybody's kind of the same. You know, we're not that different. We have, you know, we have our métier. We, you know, we're very good at certain things. But these other beings are, there are cousins, actually. We're related to them. And so we share all these wonderful things. But it turns out that if animals are equal, some are more equal than others, essentially.
John, I wanted to ask you, in the first part of your book, you have a section called Apocalypse Now. Can you flesh out that chapter?
You know, so first of all, you know, capitalism has been wrecking nature for centuries and centuries. And so the problem, like today, we all talk about global warming, and global warming is a catastrophe at every level for every being on the earth, almost every being. Some species flourish, but mostly it's a really bad news, right? But there's been this crazy narrowing of the discourse of environmentalism. If you go back to the 1970s, or even the 60s, when 1962, when Rachel Carson published Silent Spring, which really jump-started the environmental movement, Carson is talking about the deaths of animals. That's what her book is about. She's writing about DDT and other pesticides and herbicides that are poisoning animals. All of that drops out when we just talk about global warming. And then further, what drops out is, you know, as you were implying, you know, animal agriculture is a leading source of CO2s. But what I do in that chapter is say, really, first of all, the number one ecological problem today is mass species extinction, way worse than global warming, way worse. This is the worst calamity in 66 million years since the dinosaurs went extinct. And that global species extinction is not due primarily to global warming. Species were already being hounded out of existence by capitalist development and hunting and fishing and animal agriculture. Animal agriculture is arguably the largest cultural artifact ever created by our species. It dwarfs the roadways and the cities. And because, you know, most arable land is cultivated, and it's cultivated for animals, either directly or indirectly. Either we're grazing animals or we're growing monocrops like corn, to feed the animals and then to kill the animals. So very few people realize this, but 96% of all mammals on the earth are human prisoners, other than excluding humans. 96% of all mammals are in human captivity. 70% of all birds, more than two out of three birds on the earth are languishing in industrialized cages and so forth. Chickens and turkeys and others. And so this massive system is polluting the water. It's leading to global warming. It's destroying topsoil. Just all these ecological pathologies. And at the root of this, I argue, right, are two things. One is capitalist development, which treats all of nature as a proto commodity, something, a raw material on the way to becoming a commodity. So other animals and their habitats are simply viewed as raw material for production of profit. That's one big thing. And then there's this older system of human dominion that we've been talking about, which is to treat other animals as simply inferiors to be exploited, and violently exploited. So it's these two systems together, which are now inseparable, I argue, right, that is leading to the collapse of the biosphere. I mean, we are seeing huge population crashes across the board: mammals, avians, reptiles, amphibians, even crustaceans. You know, the horseshoe crab, who's been on the earth, their ancestors have been on the earth for like millions, maybe, I can't remember offhand, but I think maybe hundreds of millions of years, even before the dinosaurs got here. They're being wiped out almost overnight. Sharks were killing estimated 100 million sharks per year. So the oceans are being emptied of their conscious life and so forth. So we can't, and then the insects, pollinators and so forth, we've seen 80% collapse of insect populations. So this can't maintain, and yet nobody really is talking about it. And no one really is tying it in with what philosophers have called speciesism or human domination, human supremacy, human colonialism. Or what else do you call a planet that has been completely ruined by one species and which treats all the other species as mere instruments for its own aggrandizement?
I take it that you're not one of the people who's going to say that science is likely to solve these problems. There'll be a technical fix, like, for instance, we'll find another planet we can go to and live on, or we'll convert Mars into another planet that is livable, or something along those lines.
Yes, that drives me crazy.
Yeah, me too. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, I think it's a kind of spiritual obscenity even for us to be thinking that having trashed this planet, we have a right to go and trash another. No, it's better that we just simply end our project, if that's the model. You know, people talk about space colonization very interestingly, including the late Stephen Hawking, the physicist, forgetting what colonization actually meant. You know, which was genocide and slavery and a lot of ugly things. But, you know, all these people talk about colonizing other planets. It's, and if we can't, I mean, this is a lovely planet we're on. I mean, it is a perfect, it's well suited to the flourishing of our species. And if we can't make this work, you know, it's a kind of, I think of it as a kind of psychosis. I do. I think of it as dissociative behavior, this idea that we can turn Mars, you know, terraform. It's just, it's, I mean, it's not simply immoral in a sense. It's kind of lunacy. And getting back to bad faith, it's a kind of denial. So there was an article just reading recently in The Guardian about a study of veganism and how, I don't have the statistics offhand, but something like if we shifted to a vegan diet, there'd be something like 70% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, like radically more environmental savings from that than anything else you could do. And the way the article ends is they quote a representative of the British government saying, but, you know, we think, you know, livestock have, we should just have better livestock and we should just genetically engineer better cows to produce, right? So that's like the least efficient, talk about Occam's razor, is the least efficient, logical, moral solution to the problem. But people will do not want to let go of their attachment. And I don't think it's just to the taste of meat. I mean, I've been a vegan for 30 years and I love food and I, you know, there's a zillion things to eat. It's not that there isn't good stuff to eat. I really think that meat, you know, a lot of scholars have written about this, right? Our cultural cathexis with the flesh of another being. It confirms our status as the dominant, the apex predators, like we like to think of ourselves. We're the ones in charge. We can do what we like. And it's authentic. If you have cellular meat, which I'm not in favor, by the way, but if you grow meat in the laboratory and you eat that, people think that's gross, which is very odd. We're shooting an animal in the head and cutting it open and grabbing its innards and eating that. They think that's normal and that's authentic cuisine, you know? So there's this weird, I mean, I try to peel this layers of this aside in my book to show the underlying sadism, the bloodlust, compared to psychopathy that goes into the making of this system. But we're so attached to it, it's very hard to imagine, you know, us giving it up. But we have to give it up. It's the right thing to do. Regardless of the fact that we're destroying the whole planet, it's simply the right thing to do.
And on top of that, we are destroying the whole planet, which, of course, is where we live. And one of the shocking things to me is that not only does the argument that it's the right thing to do seem to have no hold with people, but even the argument that we now face our own extinction also doesn't seem to be capable of motivating people. Like, if that can't move you, what does? It's very perplexing.
You know, I've been thinking about, like, trying to find a language for describing this. There's a way in which, if I get on a plane and it's going to pollute and it's going to exacerbate global warming, there's a sense in which I'm doing it to myself, that I'm doing it to my species. And then since we're all doing it, in a way, it's like, I'm thinking of like a frat. Like you go to some like a fraternity and they've trashed their house. That is aesthetically bad. But is it immoral? Everybody's doing it, and it's just part of their – it's like it's an unattractive way to live a life. But now if you imagine someone coming into your house and just trashing the place and breaking everything and leaving, we would say, you know, as ethicists, I think, well, that's a different order of things. And I think that, again, the reason we are able to shop on Amazon and not think about, you know, the cobalt and where that's coming from that's in our cell phone or whatever – or the rare materials that are causing piling, you know, mountain mining pilings down, poisoning riverways, and the fish are dying. And it's a kind of malignant narcissism that we all, in a certain sense, consent. At least we first worlders who are in an industrialized, privileged world, we think, oh, well, I have to have my chocolate, or I have to have my visit. I got to go to vacation in Aruba. That's my right in a certain sense. And if, yeah, it's making things bad, but we're all in this together. I don't know. You know what I'm trying to get at? Whereas I think that what's implicit in that is a kind of contempt for all the other life forms when we participate in this capitalist consumption. We're not thinking primarily of them. And that's why, like, global warming discourse is all about us. Oh, well, our cities are going to be flooded and I won't be able to go to the beach, you know, in the summer anymore, right? So it's a self, you see what I'm saying? It's like a self-injury.
They hopefully do, although does that sentiment, which so many people feel, actually get translated into action? And that goes back to this denial and the cognitive dissonance and those statistics, Robert, that you brought up earlier of the third of Americans thinking animals should have the same rights as people and so on. Clearly, that does not in any way translate into their actions. I guess I'm thinking about this and about the moral psychology that lies behind it or helps explain some of this stuff, which to me, to some level, just seems sort of baffling. But, you know, there's some parts of it that aren't utterly baffling and are maybe worth commenting on. I want to ask you about, like, for instance, there's thoughts about complicity and active. So go back to Michael Pollan. Michael Pollan, in his book Omnivore's Dilemma, praises the idea that we should be directly involved in our food, manufacture, gathering, etc., so that it could... The act of eating meat, for instance, for him could become ethical or more ethical if I went out and hunted the meat myself and killed it myself. Now, this is a common idea to some degree, and I wanted to ask you, you know, how you feel about this or what you think about it, because I think there's what's interesting to me about this as an ethical philosopher is it seems to push people in different directions. Some people take the pollen line, at least on this issue, and say, doing it yourself, you got moral integrity. It's not indirect. It's not an element of bad faith again. You're not, paying the person to do it for you because you're too squeamish to take responsibility for it yourself. Then there are the opposite people who would say, only a cruel person could directly kill an animal in that way or something like that. But if somebody else does the killing, it's okay. Because, you're not a killer yourself. Eating meat that you buy at a grocery store or something doesn't make you a killer yourself. And then, of course, there are people, most utilitarians, I assume, would say, look, the consequence either way is a dead animal. Doesn't matter if you do the killing, if you hire somebody else to do it. So I'm curious about your thoughts on complicity, both in terms of, morally speaking, whether you think it makes any difference at all, but also maybe whether, what sort of role this is possibly playing in general attitudes about meat eating and so on.
So what we've seen in the last 15 years is, since especially pollen and the locavore movement, which began in the same period, 2006, 2007, is a rebranding of meat as an kind of a reassertion of its authenticity and as a commodity and as a natural commodity at that. And so there's been there are thousands of blogs and films and articles about do-it-yourself killing as a way of getting in touch with nature and having a closer relationship, as you say, to our food and to the land, and even having a more respectful relationship to the animals themselves. So I talk about this romanticization of this violence and in my book. And I think, I think of someone who is, say, a pedophile who the difference between downloading child porn from the web and the difference between that and setting up one's own studio to produce it in the basement, which would we say is more morally messed up? Are they both messed up? Yes. Is it? Well, we could say, well, at least the guy who's doing it in his basement isn't a hypocrite. But there are worse things than hypocrisy, and harming other vulnerable beings is one of them. So people like Michael Pollan or Barbara Kingsolver and a million others who deliberately seek out opportunities to commit acts of violent harm against vulnerable beings completely powerless at their mercy is far worse to me than the consumer who blithely goes into the supermarket and buys their shrink-wrapped, bloodless beef without thinking about the conditions of production that went into it or the animal. And in fact, I was having this interesting conversation with Emily Moran Barwick, who runs Bite Size Vegan, the channel and website. And what came out of that conversation is that actually, it is a kind of bad faith and hypocrisy to avoid the truth of what one's eating. But it's also it represents a healthy psyche, because we don't normally want to see other animals harmed. We don't want to, and that's actually, I think, a sign of a positive psyche, that you don't want to do that. So what is it saying about people who want to see the animals killed? They want to see the light go out in their eyes. Some of these people literally talk about in those terms. They want to see the animal thrash around in terror, in agony, and they can call that authenticity. Well, that's just a much deeper form of bad faith. I mean, to just go in and buy some commodity without thinking about it is bad faith. You're avoiding the truth of what. But then to actually, it's really twisted to then say, oh, well, this is better behavior, and then I'm helping the animal out. It's like the hunter who goes out and shoots some animal with a high-powered rifle and says that that's communion and it's mutual respect. And, I don't want to swear on your show, but I mean, I would call that.
Oh, Robert can bleep it. Go right ahead.
All right. Yeah, I'd say that's f***ed up, to use a technical term.
You're attuned to Philosophers on Culture here at KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico, California. I should let you know, too, that Philosophers on Culture is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Cotton Party, offering contemporary women's clothing and accessories with an emphasis on natural fibers. Cotton Party has been providing friendly service for over 30 years in the heart of downtown Chico at 337 Broadway Street. Cotton Party is grateful for your business and offers complimentary gift wrapping with each purchase. More information by calling Cotton Party at 530-893-4923.
Philosophers on Culture is also made possible by Affordable Automotive, now with four locations to serve you. Affordable Automotive on Park Avenue, Affordable Automotive West at West Sac and Nord, Chico Custom Classics at 1024 West 8th Street, and Chico Auto Care Ace Radiator at 9th and Ivy, the only radiator shop in Butte County. For over 26 years, the Chico community has entrusted the Affordable Automotive family of shops with services ranging from basic vehicle maintenance to major repairs. For appointments and details, call 530-892-1774. Or visit ChicoAutomotive.com.
Oh, hey, we should let you know, too, that if you enjoy this program, just go to your computer, go to KZFR.org, and you can tip the show. John, I can imagine a listener thinking, I don't want to have to shoot the pig in the head. I don't want to have to slit the pig's throat. But that is a natural thing. So for you to portray it this way is to actually mischaracterize the way that the natural world is.
You've hit on the problem, which, as I see it, which is, in fact, the natural. The discourse of the natural as the enemy of the good in this case. I think, you know, almost every discourse of oppression and justification for bad stuff has always or almost always gone through the natural, what's natural. It's natural for women not to play golf. It's natural for women not to be in the White House. And it's natural for men to fight war. It's natural for, you know, for rape to happen. I mean, so when we talk about the natural, or, you know, some racial groups are naturally inferior to others on cognitively, it's such a problem to talk about that. And so that's a way to shut down any question about ethics. Just, oh, well, it's just natural. Slavery was seen as natural for thousands of years. Not just seen as natural, but right. And justifications for slavery in the antebellum period often looked at the so-called natural status of animal agriculture as a form of a way to justify slavery. Well, God created the animals in order to be exploited, and yes, they are sentient and so forth. William Harper, for example, in his memoir on slavery of 1832, makes this argument that animals were put on the earth by a provident God for us to use, and it's the same with inferior humans. I mean, so that's the first thing I would say is that when people say, well, something is natural, you got to sit up and take notice, you know. And we've been talking about bad faith and as Jean-Paul Sartre, the French philosopher, referred to it, and it's very important in existentialist thought that we define ourselves. So if I'm going to say, well, to be human means to be fully human, or what it means to be naturally human is to kill and eat animals, well, that would mean that, you know, Franz Kafka and George Bernard Shaw and Tolstoy and Jane Goodall are unnatural. They're not fully human in a sense because they're all ethical vegetarians. Lions are obligate carnivores, right? They have to eat gazelles or whatever they eat. If lions were sitting around the carcass and saying, one of them was saying, you know what? Maybe we shouldn't do this. I was looking into this gazelle's eyes, and that gazelle was really unhappy about being eaten alive. And I'm not feeling right about this, guys. And the lions say, well, I just like how it tastes, you know, and we're the strongest. Then we could begin to criticize lions and say, well, look, They have this ethical discourse, and they have a choice. In fact, if one of the lions said, well, we could be doing eating this here instead, then that would be one whole, that would be a different thing. But the fact is lions don't have that choice, and they don't, as far as we know, engage in ethical discourse, even though they do have empathy and a sense of fairness and so forth. But we humans have a choice. It's as simple as that. And there's nothing – eating animals is no more natural – you know, than buying Twinkies at the store or setting environmental policy or tax policy. It's simply a cultural choice we make. Simple as that. And so do we want to cause, you know, harm or not cause harm? That's a choice. So, and the other thing is that we're omnivores. And omnivores doesn't mean that we have some natural metaphysical telos or like a built-in purpose to eat other beings. It means simply that we evolved to be capable of that as part of our complement. We're also capable of eating humans. And we do, you know, humans have committed, enacted cannibalism for thousands of years. Well, we wouldn't say if I go and kill my neighbor and eat him, and I go to the cops and say, well, it was natural because I'm an omnivore and I can eat flesh, therefore I should eat flesh. And it was good, by the way, officer. We that would not go over well in a court of law, you know. You know, if I say, well, I had these kids in order to raise them for meat, and then when they turned 10, I slaughtered them, yes, and I dressed them, and then I ate them. And they had a great life up till the very end, and they had a bullet in the back of the head. And what's wrong with that? You know, from a utilitarian point of view, it's hard to say what's wrong with that. But I think it's evident to most people why that would be wrong. And I think similarly, you know, in all deference to the ranchers of Chico and so forth, that they know at some level that they don't have to do this. And it's simply a rationalization to say that, well, everyone else does it. Because, in fact, we tend to kill the vegan animals. You know, cows are not... are not hurting anybody. They're not predators, and they can chickens and cows can flourish and have flourished without human intervention or control. So they're not. But we think that they're better off in our control. But every one of them will be killed at a young age. Whereas chickens, say, who have escaped slaughterhouses, some of them have gone on to form colonies. For example, in Hawaii, you know, or the wild parrots of Telegraph Hill in San Francisco. If you know that these parrots who were not native to the area, once they escaped human control, they had wonderful lives they built for themselves.
I wanted to go back to a bit more moral psychology in terms of understanding why it is, again, that there seems to be some of these disconnects between values that I do think people have in some way or feel in some way or acknowledge and their actions and the decisions that they make. And there's at least one more phenomenon here I wanted to mention as an explanation, not really as an argument. But I do think that these days there is just a kind of moral exhaustion on the part of so many people that people feel like, yes, of course, I know in some way I shouldn't be eating meat. The same way I know that I shouldn't be filling my gas tank with this gas that, you know, is implicated in wars in the Middle East, etc. I know that people are dying over there because of this gas. And I could try to extricate my... And again, part of what comes in here is that idea about complicity, right? That, look, I wouldn't go over to the Middle East myself maybe and kill people in order to fill my tank. But since it's already happened and it's been done, whatever, I know I'm a tiny part of this very big chain. There's nothing I can do about it. It's not going to stop if I refuse to drive my car. I can't have any meaningful impact on it. I can try to extricate myself from all this stuff and live pure. And I'm still in a million ways going to be wrapped up in this whole terrible system, which is just so bad in so many ways. It's pointless. You know, I feel now there's many people who I think are just totally immune from this because they think the system's wonderful and they're either not aware of any of this bad stuff and these connections and the impacts we have on animals and other people and so on, or they've kept themselves separate and ignorant from it. But I also think there's a lot of people with much better intentions who really do want to be good people on some level, and yet who do have that feeling and at some point have to some degree given up. And maybe there's some things they do to try to be better, but then there's also a lot of things where they'll say, yeah, I know I could still be better and better and better, and I would never really be good, or I would never be good enough, or I would never be able to be free from causing harm. And so I just got tired, or I just drew the line here, right, or whatever it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a good point, and it's really the central problem of our time in a certain sense.
Yeah.
And part of it is, and this shows the limits of moral philosophy, right, is that in the absence of a robust political movement or a social movement that, right, is able to give people hope for structural change, the individual feels like, well, why bother? What can I do anyway? And as you say, you know, we have knowledge now of sweatshops and, you know, animal issues and the environment. It's all like too much for people. And not only that, we have every disincentive to think about these things. Like it's much easier to get in your car and drive somewhere than to figure out the bus to the train to the you know, public transportation is a disincentive. And similarly for meat, if you go as I do go to a cafe and I want like a non-dairy milk, you get charged a fee, so you have an economic disincentive to do the right thing. I could give you 100 examples like that, and you know them. So So, yeah, and this, again, though, is where bad faith comes in, because it's sort of like, well, I already take out the recycling, so I can't give up meat, you know? I mean, there's a sense in which people are just that idea that every issue is of equal importance or ought to be viewed as with equal importance is itself a dodge, okay? I don't think that what we do to animals is the same as not recycling or something. And the very notion that it is a symptom of our contempt for the lives, the worthlessness as we see them of other animals' lives. But I completely agree, and I think, and you know, that's why this project, I mentioned capitalism, the structure of consumer capitalism treats us, interpolates us as monads, as self-interested, pleasure-seeking, pain-avoiding robots. That's how it treats us, and we're only supposed to think of our own needs. And so, you know, all of us in this room have taught moral philosophy. We teach it to undergraduates. And they, and in my experience, when undergraduates come into my classroom, they are completely morally confused. They subscribe to like 10 different elements of 10 different moral theories, including moral relativism, ethical egoism, psychological egoism, you know, a little smattering of, you know, deontology, consequentially, you know. And they don't care that they don't know that they have contradictory beliefs. And secondly, that it doesn't bother them. I think, you know, consistency in belief is something that bothers philosophers a lot, you know, or people who have a strong moral compass. But increasingly in our society, and we could have a whole conversation about ChatGPT, but I'll just mention it because I think that what we're seeing is a general corruption in the society where, you know, going back to Socrates or whatever, the idea that the majority, whatever the majority thinks is right, must be right. Moral relativism is more and more common, and we have this idea that there's safety in numbers, which in ethics is the exact opposite, right? There's never, you know, you don't go along with what the other person's doing. You want to live in what Kant called the kingdom of ends. You want to imagine a world in which doing the right thing, everyone was doing it, and then you do it. If you're in a society of murderers, of course it's easier to just be a murderer like your neighbor. But according to Kant, anyway, in a society of murderers, you still should be a good person and not murder. And it doesn't get you off the hook that everyone else around you sucks. But, yeah, so again, I completely agree. And I'm glad you introduced, you know, moral psychology, because just structurally and culturally, everything is, you know, there are all these obstacles put up in front and before us in our path to keep us from asking the deeper questions or changing our behavior, which, of course, is the hardest thing. Because I find that my students all agree after they watch some of these videos. And listeners, I recommend you watch a film called Meet Your Meat. It's an old film by PETA. It's very good. It's only about 12 minutes. When they see that film, half my students are like crying or, you know, they're very moved. And they reject it completely. Almost none of them will become vegetarian. It's a disconnect between what we know to be right and then the work. But, you know, Aristotle, it's virtue ethics. To be a good person requires practice, work. You have to train yourself to be good. But, you know, most people would just rather veg out.
Talk a little bit about volunteerism versus systemic change.
Yeah, so Marx talks about, you know, obviously Marx is the theorist par excellence of capitalism and what capitalism is. And Marx describes a dialectic between production and consumption. You know, dialectical thought is very complicated, but simply they're connected. And so in order for capital to realize profit, you have to have, obviously, the production of a good, and you have to have the desire for that good. If capitalists produced products that nobody wanted, the rancher was producing meat that no one wanted, then he or she's right. That would be the end of that. So it's both at once. It's not an either-or thing. Marx's emphasis, I think he was right, was to talk about production as the origin point for ideas and for the norms, cultural norms we have around commodities. So on the one hand, if I as an individual say, well, it's too much bother for me to think about the fact that I'm buying a shirt made in a sweatshop and I'm not going to buy the fair trade product, That's a kind of cop-out. And I think just basic moral hygiene requires us to take responsibility for our actions. However, if I'm just a vegan and I think, well, I've done my bit, I'm just buying vegan products so I can pat myself on the back, that's a cop-out. Because guess what? You know, I've been a vegan for 30 years personally, and actually more animals are being killed today than were then. Meat consumption in the U.S. per capita is up. So evidently, that's not enough either, right? So, you know, part of what Troy, you're calling, you know, moral fatigue is tied to the political crisis we're in and the fact that, you know, the liberal state is in crisis. We're moving towards fascism and populist authoritarianism. The ecology of the planet is collapsing. The culture is, in a way, disintegrating. People aren't able to locate themselves epistemically within a system that, where truth is fragmented or discourses through digital media fragmented, blah, blah, blah. This is just, it's a the individual has almost nothing to cling to other than their own self-interest. So there's a crisis of collective mobilization. Like, what do we do? How do we confront these institutions that define us in so many ways? And they do define us. They define our needs and our desires. You know, I used to teach a class on video games, philosophy and ethics of video games at my college. And, you know, students confirm that they now dream about, video games. I mean, video game culture has penetrated their unconscious as well as their conscious self. Well, video games, video game culture is very toxic. I mean, it's militaristic, it's violent, it's misogynistic. Just one example of a kind of cultural product of capitalism that has consequences for the way we think and perceive ourselves and the other. So it's very daunting to think about, but we have to do both things at once. We have to try to reason with one another and say, look, let's try not to do this. You have to understand that when we buy meat, quote meat, what we're doing is we're engaging in evil. It's something that's really, really terrible. At the same time, even if the world became vegan overnight, there's still the fact that capitalism is destroying the ecosystem. So if you care about the cows and pigs who are being exploited, you got to care about the orangutans and the macaws and the tortoises and, you know, the leatherback turtles at sea who are all going extinct, the monarch butterflies. It's a package deal. So vegan consumption is not, you know, of course I promote it and I think everyone should stop buying animal products, but that alone doesn't change the fundamental structure. Capitalism is fine with vegan products. In fact, the vegan companies have been mostly bought out by meat companies because there's a profit to be. But they're fine. The meat companies are fine producing both, and that's the plan right now. They're going to continue forever to have like niche products of, you know, vegan sausages and then sausages made from intensively raised animals. And so if we only take a consumerist model, then everybody gets what they like. You like veganism and I like meat. You know, it's toleration. It's celebrate diversity. You know, it's meatless Mondays. And when I hear meatless Mondays, I think, oh, yeah, and I'm not going to commit sexual assault on Tuesdays and Fridays. And I'm only going to be a racist on Wednesdays. But, you know, but what could be more trivializing than meatless Mondays? Oh, yeah, I'm going to, you know, because everybody's saying, all the scientists are saying, well, everyone should cut back on, you know, reduce your meat consumption. Implicit in that is the idea that the animals, we don't give up flying, you know, whatever, about those creatures. All we care about is, quote, the environment. And so reducitarianism and flexitarianism have built into them this contempt for the lives of other animals who are viewed as literally worthless. Their lives are worthless. If we didn't view other animals' lives as worthless, how could we kill 60 billion land animals every year and up to 1 to 3 trillion marine animals every single year? Well, to me, that does signify that culturally speaking or collectively, we view their lives as worthless.
Well, it looks like we've hit the end of our time together. But John, it's been a really provocative and super interesting conversation. John Sambomatsu, who is the author of, coming out next year, John, right? The Omnivore's Deception, What We Get Wrong About Meat Animals and the Nature of Moral Life. Thank you for spending time here on Philosophers on Culture.
thank you both. It was a wonderful conversation, and I'm excited about your new enterprise. I'm going to.
You are tuned to listener supported community radio 90.1 KZFR in Chico. 6 o'clock, right on the money. Time for Butte Views and Beyond.